Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning to steer this ship into the darkest depths of the human mind as we go across the pond and endeavor to shed light upon the harrowing murder of 2-year-old James Bulger in the Walton area of Liverpool on February 12, 1993. While this case was solved fairly quickly, it became notorious in the public eye for a very specific reason, which is that the perpetrators of this gruesome beating death were 2 10-year-old boys, Robert Thompson and John Venables. And while we have received some answers as to why these kids would have indulged such heinous violence, the greater part of the mystery remains. So what we want to do here is deconstruct the narrative leading to the fatal incident and the killer's behavior thereafter in order to garner a better idea of what motivated this event. Now, as we know, the end is always the beginning, and vice versa. We merely have to go to the end of this story first to see what precipitated the incident. So, emotional wounds are what cause physical compensation through evolutionary shortcuts, which is defined as sociopathy, or antisocial personality disorder, as it's more commonly and broadly addressed today. If we identify the wound, then we'll be able to see the shortcut involved here. More importantly, the value in understanding the symbolic narrative at play is that it allows us a view inside the perpetrator's head through structure rather than the arbitrary and subjective bullshit afforded by traditional psychological evaluation. With over 30 years of psychoanalysis, we are definitely no closer to understanding this crime. So, going to the end of the book to find the beginning, I look to a fact about the killing combined with a comment made by one of the perpetrator's therapists, and truth begins to rise. Both boys, at the culmination of this story, will deny that this event involved the sexual component. Yet, not only were the police able to ascertain that Thompson came from a physically abusive background, but they suspected Venables did as well, despite denials, as his behavior was atrocious. Accordingly, in the crime, everything is left on display for the whole world to see, from the method of killing to the instrument to the body, all right out in the open in public. Yet, James Bulger, who had been stripped of his clothes from the waist down, was also said to have had batteries inserted into his anus before being removed. Even though the investigation revealed that element as being true, and James was obviously nude from the waist down, the boys denied it to the end. They said there was no sexual component. They were willing to concede the brutal murder occurred, but not sexual abuse. That extent of secrecy speaks very strongly to shame, yet that secrecy is also the key to understanding why people who are unable to come out and say how they've been hurt often resort to symbolic narratives acted out in physicality when the problem boils over and becomes emotionally irreconcilable. People do not indulge symbolic narratives on a conscious, rational level, meaning that Thompson and Venables aren't going to say to each other, "Hey, since we're abused, angry, and afraid to talk, we should tell our story in pictures to help the outside world understand." That doesn't happen. It simply manifests through tragic fate. All narratives are symbolically constructed simply because there is nothing else. At the core of our existence, we are literally nothing more than the symbols comprising what we understand as the straight line and the circle. There is, again, quite literally, nothing else. Everything we are and will ever be is an extension of that symbolic rendering. The straight line and the circle can make anything you see and also many things you don't, which is why the basis for binary coding, regardless of how many languages you veil it with, will always just be 1-0, or the straight line and the circle. That isn't some weird theory I've cooked up in my head. That is a structural fact. Your physical reality is supporting your emotional life, but your mind, ironically and by way of binary necessity within the social veil, has been designed to perceive the physical reality as the basis for what affects your emotional life. That is absolute nonsense. We go out every day into the world and think, if nothing bad happens in my physical reality, then I'll be okay emotionally. And we think like that specifically because it's how we experience it. In our experience, negative physical occurrences lead to negative emotion. They precede emotion. That's necessary because the social veil necessitates that you believe people or avatars are at fault by way of choices or free will and not design or programming. In order to be able to blame others for their bad choices, they have to be perceived as having caused the pain. So the physical action precedes emotion. It's a structural thing. Yet in our construction, it is a fact that our physical reality is not even created until we've measured it, which is done by way of your eyes looking at something. If it has not been measured, meaning it has not been subjected to sensory input, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist in that moment because it doesn't have to. The world operates on necessity. Only that which needs to exist will manifest. Everything else remains in a superposition of possibility not available to your eyes. If you had evolved to become a fourth-dimensional being rather than a creature designed with eyes creating a three-dimensional reality, you would, in theory, be able to see the entirety of that superposition, or complete universe, meaning the totality of all possible outcomes which are happening at once. Time, or depth, is the element that allows this process to play out incrementally instead. If you learn about symbolism in a third-rate English class, then your understanding of it might be cursory, at best, which is fine, but not for the purposes of what I do. I bring a deeper level of sophistication to this endeavor. Now, let's talk about the crime itself and interweave personal information about the two perpetrators along the way. I think we'll find a good deal of clarity here. So, it's February 12, 1993, and two 10-year-old boys, Robert Thompson and John Venables, have decided they're not going to school. Truancy is common among these two. In fact, they're attending school less often than they're skipping it. And while indulging this truancy, the boys have begun the journey to becoming criminals. It starts with petty shoplifting at first. Robert and John have a propensity for walking around in different shops and taking things from the adults there that, quite obviously, don't belong to them. So we ask ourselves, if they're manifesting the idea of physically stealing objects from adults, then what emotional subject comprises their emotional wound? Meaning, if we reverse that notion and place it in emotional terms, then what is being taken from them psychologically by adults? Well, to answer, we simply ask where this trail leads, which is the death of James Bulger, who is what? A little boy. The physicality of killing a little boy or stealing his life, when placed in an emotional context, becomes stealing innocence, or even more specifically, killing innocence. It happens through force. So then, if these kids are abused, meaning they were being physically abused at home, leading to an emotional fallout, what could we say is being done to them? Their innocence is being taken by force, or physicality. Change is being forced on them. Now, consider adolescence. What happens? Change, specifically in relation to sexuality, takes your innocence and forces you to become a sexual creature. So due to that irony, those who are physically abused in childhood often have issues related to managing their burgeoning sexuality later, especially in cases involving alternative lifestyles, because the secrecy of hiding their sexual preference then matches the narrative of hiding the abuse. So if your father physically or sexually abuses you, and you are in fact a child who will come to realize you're gay in adolescence, or at least bisexual, that veil of secrecy can be even that much harder to break because you aren't simply afraid someone might hurt you for being that person. It's already happened, and it was dealt with only in the context of secrecy. So what happens is you reach adolescence and proceed to hide your sexuality. Now, those with the greatest propensity for doing so will be those whose childhood abuse has corrupted their sexuality in a manner that makes them later seek children in the same way to compensate for what happened to them. Abused people are told the abuse is normal and that it's supposed to remain a secret. So what we need to understand is that there are children like these two, as young as 10, who already have years of corrupted sexual experience in which the abuse they suffered was normalized in a way that they just continue the tradition. Now, in the same way an abusive male separates a male child from his mother to force sexuality through abuse, nature also forces male children away from the mother in adolescence in favor of replacing her with a sexually oriented partner. So in this case, the basis for the crime needs to be a boy being taken away from his mother for the purposes of forced physical abuse. Now, what causes so much rage in abusive homes in relation to the mother is that she becomes complicit in facilitating the secrecy of the abuse, whether she's actively involved in it or not. What that does is it sends a message to the child that she doesn't care about him getting hurt. She doesn't care that he's been taken away from her and forced into beatings and sexual situations by an angry man. And it's always because she's scared. So to punish their mothers for the willful ignorance and restore balance through revenge, Robert and John are going to manipulate a circumstance in which they take a small boy from his mother by force, and in her ignorance, leave her to have the horrible realization that her actions have led to killing that child. This is about showing the mother what she has done and making her pay the price for it. And we understand that's 100% true because of the actions of these young killers. During their crime, Robert and John make absolutely no attempts whatsoever to conceal what they're doing. It all happens in public and with many witnesses, except for the part in which the mother's ignorance leads to a realization of what she's done and how it's hurt the boy. Prior to finding James, supposedly on the same day, Robert and John picked out a boy who was in a shop with his mother. They lured him away from her, but his mother finally turned and saw what was happening. Instead of running off with the kid, they told him to go back to his mom and simply abandoned their mission there. Her lack of ignorance, her caring, deflated the symbolic narrative. They need a mother to have that shocking moment of realization when her son is gone and never coming back, both at the moment of seeing James is gone from the store and then later when he's dead, so that it matches the two-phase narrative of first losing your innocence emotionally through abuse as a boy, and then physically later as a teen. An abused boy first loses his innocence emotionally, and then upon reaching adolescence, it happens physically. So these killers want James's mother to first experience it emotionally, meaning, oh shit, I emotionally realize I've lost him, and then subsequently she learns that loss, or what's been taken, is physical and permanent and can't be undone. That's the point of the killing. To say the death of their innocence, of their childhood, can't be undone. That leaves a person stuck between the past and the future, unable to move forward or even go back. So just like the debris orbiting in the movie Gravity, if you don't get out of the way and have stopped moving, it's going to run you over. Of course, disunity between body and mind causes this. So by the end of this tale, we should learn that the killers manifested the idea of not being able to go forward or backward emotionally and how it caused death, specifically disunity between body and mind, that left them both torn apart and unable to find unity or peace. In adolescence, nature tears apart the boy you are for the man you'll become. All of which is to say that the circumstances of James' death will explicitly render the secret emotional desires of the perpetrators that they've been conditioned to keep secret. Telling the story in symbolism is a compensation for such, and it doesn't come as a product of the rational mind. These things rise from the unconscious mind, and symbolism projected into physicality is the language that area of your brain speaks. It does not have a rational connection to your thoughts. Your connection to it is only intuitive. So when we act out these manifested symbolic narratives, they are forced by the unconscious mind in the absence of our explicit awareness of what they mean, as the thing precipitating their arrival has not made those circumstances clear to you yet. 10-year-old boys generally don't have an explicitly realized connection to their sexuality and rely on intuitive messages delivered over time as they mature. But an abused boy who is 10 might literally have years of forced sexual experience in which these ideas, through corruption, became explicit long before they should have. That means an abused child sexually maturing in adolescence is going to have a far less intuitive and more explicitly realized understanding of what's happening. It can be confusing and frightening, but for those who have been abused, that confusion and fright was brought to bear at a significantly younger age. So in this story, we have a pair of 10-year-olds who would otherwise just be on the precipice of sexual realization in the near future, but are instead so entrenched in the years of suffering related to their abuse that they can define a path to physically achieving balance or the perception of such through the act of manifesting revenge. The first step in the path of emotional maturation at that age is the realization that the child is being separated from the mother permanently and that the child will be torn apart, so to speak, in order to be reborn or reassembled both physically and emotionally as a man, which means we should see Robert and John indulge those ideas in their chosen venue and actions. That process of ripping the old self or ego apart, like the dark energy expanding the universe in order to be reborn, is what precipitates the awareness. So at our first stop, we should see this manifested. Now, strangely enough, throughout history, sexuality, and especially male sexuality or maturity, has had a strong correlation to hunting animals. Of course, in older cultures, one generally became a man as a rite of passage at a much younger age because the necessity of education and being sheltered until full maturity, like we have in modern society, was absent for the most part. That meant that a boy becoming a man, in terms of his sexual awakening, or puberty, often coincided with his rite of passage granted by elders, in terms of the hunt. So, as we often find a correlation between sex and violence, it remains true here. The reason is that sex is symbolic of creation and violence of death, which combined allow the balance necessitated by a universe dependent upon a zero balance of energy. In those traditional terms, men were considered dominant and women submissive in the same sense as a predator dominating its prey. So in those primitive cultures, a boy could prove to a girl or a young woman that he was a man by being competent at the hunt, which translated to her not in terms of killing, but creation, and made him a more suitable sexual partner to procreate. It's a rebirth narrative, so it will manifest in this case in a ridiculous way. The hunt ultimately removes the transparent barrier between the predator and its prey. All of which is to say, we'll have that element here in this story. James is going to be taken to a place in which hunted prey or animals can be displayed to his mother or the woman, and ironically, in turn, also have James be advertised as the same to the killers. Prey. Watch the symmetry unfold. James accompanies his mom, Denise, to a butcher shop that afternoon. We have our hunted dead animals. While she's shopping for what's behind the glass, luring the shopkeeper for help, outside the store, and also literally behind the glass, Robert Thompson and John Venables are luring their prey, her son. All of this happens right out in the open because nobody thinks 2 10-year-olds have murderous intentions. Kids play games, right? So when these guys choose what they want, of course, Denise chooses what she wants. They both choose their prey. And then Denise goes to pay. In doing so, she lets go of James's hand, and he quickly wanders away, even faster than she thought possible, because the predators were already luring him. All James needs to do is make it out the door in his mother's ignorance to satisfy them. Now, the police believed that Robert Thompson was the more dominant of the two perpetrators, and that's something that becomes apparent on CCTV. Though it was 1993, the CCTV footage that captured part of the abduction showed Robert Thompson walking out in front of John Venables, and Venables was the one holding the boy's hand. Thompson is leading the way. So, where are they going? And better yet, why? Now, what is a common metaphor used for the path we take in a modern context? The road of life. Well, the road of life for these two killers has been a bumpy one, to say the least. While again, there were denials of abuse in the Venables home, it became well documented that Thompson's experience was entirely abusive. Venables, however, once strangled a fellow student at school with a ruler, among many other infractions, so beneath the denials, we understand something was wrong. So, if you were physically and emotionally abused in secrecy so that society couldn't know and step in to help, and along that metaphorical road of life since you were a small child, what physically manifested revenge would suffice here? Well, if you're being abused, you have to tell someone to make it stop. You have to make the secret known. So since they can't do it emotionally, they simply reverse that value of secrecy physically and take James literally along the road of life, which becomes real roads, but in society where everyone can see and can step in and help the child. This is a cry for help, and a lot of witnesses had a chance to stop this, but even though James was punched, kicked, and slammed to the ground along the way, no one, not even the people who stopped to care, did enough to prevent what came next. And think about this, how hard is it to stop 2 10-year-olds? Not very hard, right? It's testament to how difficult it can be to get anyone to both believe you and do enough about the circumstances to keep you from getting killed for exposing the abuser if you were to make that choice. Nobody in this case takes the initiative to stand up for this child, meaning James, in a way that will save him. So he dies. It's a tragedy because that's exactly what the perpetrators experienced in their lives. Even on the occasions others became witness to the abuse or suspected it, they didn't stop it. It's amazing how that idea manifests in this story when you consider that these kids are literally beating a 2-year-old in broad daylight and in public. But that's the point of nature crafting such a narrative. It's what those two boys experienced from a very young age. They wanted people to look on in horror and stop them and ask why. Otherwise, they wouldn't have walked an abducted child through public for 2.5 miles. They wanted to be seen, and so badly at that, but they never were, at least not in a meaningful way that would stop the abuse. That's the point. They wanted someone to make them stop because they wanted that person to realize what they were doing in public. It was what was really happening to them at home in private. They were manifesting their emotional world. This is their way of telling the secret without breaking the code of silence. If the recipient has a realization of truth, it's derived from intuition and not fact by way of the child's words. The child is always most afraid to reveal the secret because the secret has always been presented to them as something that comes with dire consequences if it gets out. So not stopping the abuse has dire consequences. No one does enough to make it stop. So James dies physically, matching what happened to Robert's and John's childhoods emotionally. Now, if this crime happened, it means Robert and John lost hope that anyone would stop the abuse in their childhoods, and therefore their childhoods died, so to speak. It was emotionally irreconcilable, so the issue spilled onto a physical canvas where they handled it. At 10 years old, a boy normally doesn't sense himself soon being separated from his mother in favor of girls or boys his age, but given the abuse Robert and John allegedly endured, they likely have a much more explicit awareness of their sexuality than other kids their age might. And whatever they realized meant that this sexual awakening was the official death of their childhoods. There was no hope. When a boy's sexuality is realized, it's the first step in separation from his mother. So they're manifesting that idea by taking James away from his mother. There's no returning to mom, and James never does. So they take him along the road of life, abusing him the whole way. And just imagine what's going through little James's thoughts. He clearly wants his mommy back, but this road has taken him to a place in which he'll never have her. And it hurts, like the beatings and the big people screaming at him. He wishes mommy would come save him, but she can't because he's already gone. He cries out in whatever way he can for help, but nobody seems to hear him. Well, they hear him, but they fear the consequences of getting involved, at least to a great extent, so they don't. And he watches them, even the concerned ones, finally pass him by. There's no help. There's no way out. This is what the two killers were suffering at home. This is a cycle of abuse, a cycle of violence. To point the finger at any one person is to ignore a machine that never stops turning in favor of believing choices can heal people. Our evolutionary narrative as humans is about being saved. It's about redemption. And if anyone stopped that situation, James would have been saved. Robert and John ultimately would have been redeemed, but only through realization of the truth. Maybe someday you'll see something like this. Maybe you'll go the distance because of something I said. Maybe you'll save someone and be redeemed. This is why we evolve. This is why new ideas are forced upon us and make us uncomfortable. It's easy to criticize. It's easy to be defensive and call someone crazy. Evolution, increasingly so as we indulge technological transcendence, forces us to have realizations from which we can never go back. Many people, of course, will shun those realizations. Ignorance is bliss, but in this case, we see the tragic fate of willful ignorance. So in the future, the things I talk about will be common knowledge. In my lifetime, though, there'll be an asterisk that says, above all else, it's interesting, but I don't agree. Anyhow, like I said, the aspiring young hunter on the verge of the rite of passage in certain cultures of the past would kill the beast and display it, and that dominance would attract a woman, thereby making him not only reborn as the dominant predator or animal in the wild by way of the kill, but subsequently also, and ironically, domesticating him in the sense that he will make a family with the woman he attracted. First comes the kill, then the rebirth, and finally the domestication. So we'll see that here. The son, James, leaves the mother along the straight line of the hunt at the butcher shop, symbolizing the kill by way of dead animals. So manifested in physicality, to be reborn, where do they need to go? They're leaving a butcher shop, right? Where do they need to go to be reborn? Somewhere with live animals, right? Not only that, but it has to be what type of live animals? Domesticated. Accordingly, Robert and John take James to a pet shop. So now the animals are alive, manifesting the idea of rebirth. But nature has to say, hey guys, this ain't working. You can't do it this way. So what happens next? They get kicked out of the pet shop. So look at that. If the animals come back to life, it means they never went on the hunt. So we see what they're doing here. They're reversing this narrative to take themselves back to the beginning, back to childhood, rather than those narratives we see about the men who leave the dead body at the bottom of the hill and rise to the top. These kids are trying to go back to childhood rather than kill the childhood inside them and move on to be men. And why? Because they have a secret and they're not ready to deal with it. More about that soon. Now, as opposed to what I talked about with a man failing to transcend manifesting a circumstance in which he leaves a dead child at the bottom of a hill while he ascends to the top, symbolically becoming the father and killing the child inside him, so to speak, Robert and John are angry for the opposite reason. They don't want their childhood to end because it's brought on the awakening of their sexuality and, according to structure, even if corrupted, their desire to hunt. So if between the two of them, they shared an unspoken but realized secret beyond the abuse and in relation to their sexuality, one that they wanted to become physically unrealized by restoring their childhoods and sending that realization back down into the dark waters of the unconscious mind, where would they take the boy to do that? And what would the secret be? Well, there is a man who, as an adult, claims to have had a long-term relationship with Robert Thompson after the adult Thompson was a free man. I think it's as simple as realizing that something that happens frequently came to bear here. Prepubescent friends often become such because they have a lot in common. And sometimes, because kids are yet to be defined very well in their lives, especially on an emotional level, those commonalities aren't very well defined either. Sure, if both of you play baseball, that might bring you together, but for many relationships, there exists an unspoken but always present sense of balance allowed by the partnership. In the case of heterosexual boys, no sexual tension is going to arise to change the friendship beyond competition for girls. But for 10-year-old friends who come to realize an attraction to each other because of their corrupted, more explicit understanding of sexuality derived from abuse, there's a serious problem. 10-year-olds are not emotionally equipped to deal with something like that on a rational level. But I believe these two were forced into an early reconciliation process of losing their childhood and realizing their sexuality, and therefore that disunity between their childlike bodies and adult minds manifested in sociopathy. If you look at how they're parading this kid around town and think about what would happen if they got caught, it comes down to one necessary idea, which happened in the end through manifested ironic fate instead of realization by those around them. What do we do when two boys are bad influences on each other and won't stop being partners in crime? We force their separation, right? We don't allow them to hang out. But no matter how awful these deeds got, no matter how many days of school they missed due to truancy, or how many times they shoplifted, what remains an honest assessment of the situation? They were never separated. Not until they forced it to happen in the worst way. They put James between them as a projection of the boy they lost inside them, taking him along the road of life, constantly in tears, constantly being beaten, crying out for help, but receiving nothing but pain that finally renders the child dead at the end. So to unrealize their dead childhood, they take James to a canal. That will be our abyss, the place of change from which we emerge cleansed and reborn. It's the mirror universe. And guess what they're going to do? They tell him to get down on his knees and look down into the water at his reflection. That's symbolic of him looking into his emotional world. And they want him to suffer that because it's what they're now suffering. But these guys want to send the problem back down. Down to the abyss where it could be unrealized. Watch nature tell them the issue. They push James forward in a manner that will send him headfirst into the canal, but nature needs to manifest the idea of this being an emotional issue, not a physical one, so James, a projection of these boys, falls and hits what instead? His head. So James's physical pain outside his head matches the emotional pain inside theirs. It's a reflection. Right in a moment where he was literally looking at his reflection. That's how your emotional world works in relation to your physical reality. Like happens in the pet shop experience, they fail, but they learn a lesson. Going through the abyss of emotional change requires suffering. Yet, ironically, that's why they're refusing it, because they've already suffered so much and can bear no more. The realization of what they're becoming scares their 10-year-old minds because it shouldn't normally happen until later. Worse, we also see that their corrupted sexuality, like it did to their abusers, caused them to also be attracted to children, even small children. So they could see themselves becoming their abusers and wanted to say it. They wanted to put a stop to it. In fact, they did. They did say it. They screamed it at the top of their lungs, but only in symbolism, and nobody did a fucking thing to stop it because they didn't understand how to speak that language. John Venables, as an adult after having changed his name, was supposedly arrested for possession of child porn involving small kids. It's not difficult to see what happened here. This is the cycle of abuse and violence perpetuating itself. These boys were having bad feelings that killed them emotionally, so that pain gets projected physically onto James. It's one boy because it symbolically says, "We're the same," without coming out explicitly and saying it. They were too young to handle this situation emotionally, and ignoring it caused it to spill out physically. We saw a similar emotional disposition in relation to the Slender Man stabbing. Two girls of approximately that age put another between them as a projection of what they were becoming because they were simply too young to handle the truth emotionally, leading them to try to kill the threat physically to compensate. In the aftermath, it wasn't difficult to see that what they needed was forced separation because they were simply too young on an emotional level to deal with the love that they felt for each other. I think that's something a lot of people miss in their assessments of abuse. We most often think of abuser and abused as being black and white, or two separate entities. But sometimes, or many times, in cases like this one and the Slender Man stabbing, it works more like a shared psychosis among young friends, maturing to a shared, irreconcilable realization in which they're both abuser and victim, causing a cycle that needs to be broken. You have to break or extract the cycle or circle with the straight line. So it manifested in the Slender Man case as a knife. Once the stabbing happened, the girls were finally separated, allowing them relief from an emotional issue they were too young to reconcile rationally because they weren't mature enough to do so. The importance of understanding symbolic narratives is that symbolism is the subtext of action, so to speak, and provides meaning in places where it would otherwise be absent. The Creator is not present in the universe explicitly, and therefore speaks to us through design or architecture projected as symbolism. If there are birds in the sky, you can have realizations about what it takes to fly. If waves crash on shore, you can understand how gravitational waves work. The world is full of these things, and your mind, along with your eyes, is calibrated to see them, or conversely, remain ignorant in accordance with the current state of evolution or maturity. Evolution is not learning. It's a calibrated process of disseminating truth. Think of it like this. Imagine you're in a dark room, well, because you really are, and turn on the light. But the light takes about 42 billion years to enlighten everything inside the room, which prevents you from knowing absolute truth about its contents until then. It's how we get the expression, "a light went on in my head," to describe realizations. Now again, we have kids here who want to stay kids. So rather than going up the hill, crossing the straight lines, and merging the father and son characters with disembodiment leading to the son remaining dead at the bottom of the hill while the father transcends at the top and disappears, the son will go to the top, the lines will remain uncrossed, refusing the suffering of transformation as depicted on the crucifix of Christ, and instead of the father moving on alone, two boys or sons do that. They just make the father and son, or Jesus and God characters, both Jesus or the son, so that they never have to become the father, even by way of structure. It would be impossible in this manifestation with two boys. In doing so, they inadvertently tell us the truth that their pairing would not produce a child, and so therefore we have James dead at the top of the hill. In that, we see the reason it wouldn't produce a child is that, again, they are both boys, which screams in symbolism, but without explicitly saying it, that these kids are gay, or at least bisexual and attracted to each other. This is the best way they can tell us, and again, it's not a rational consideration. That which rises from the unconscious mind seeks the light and acknowledgement, but if you refuse it entry, it will break down the door from darkness and emerge as a monster to deliver what you wanted only in the worst, most tragic way possible. They wanted to be separated, and when it didn't happen through emotional change, it happened in physicality in the most tragic way possible. Now here's what happens. They walk James up the hill to a place that we know has to offer two uncrossed lines that represent them, which become, of course, railroad tracks. And if they need to be separated, and emotional disunity between body and mind is what caused that necessity, then in physicality, I'm sure you can see that the combination of a moving train and the idea of disunity become relevant in a scary way. So again, the victim is not left at the bottom of the hill. He actually ascends with them. Meaning what? There will be no father at the top. It's so sad to realize what they wanted in this horrible murder. They wanted to reach higher ground emotionally, a place in which their fathers or abusive father figures don't exist, and in which the two of them never cross or merge to become one, like the uncrossed tracks that stay together, but never do what? It's so sad. What do they never do? The tracks never touch each other. They remain together, right by each other's side, going right into the future, but they never, ever touch. Imagine yourself in such a bad place emotionally that you resort to doing this because you can't speak the truth. That's why my work is important. I'm speaking for people who can't. There are too many children suffering like this, and wielding a pitchfork and a torch is too easy. It's too easy. The uncrossed tracks mean no father. That's how you get to the Father. That's the suffering of Jesus crossing the straight lines to become the redundant straight lines, making one straight line of the Father at the top of the hill. So here we have the uncrossed tracks at the top, again, meaning there is no Father at the top. That's the place to which they want to ascend, one where there is no Father. That is so emotionally painful, I can barely even talk about it. I mean, there is no merger at the intersection of the seeker and the sought here. The Father never arrives. That's what they want. And when they leave, those two lines representing them, the two sons, now that the Father has been eliminated, going backward and forward, representing the past and present, and as far as the eye can see, never touch. If you followed those rails the whole way and back, they would never touch. They just stay together by each other's sides and remain exactly the same no matter how far they go. They never have to be alone. They remain by each other's side forever, but they don't touch. That is the product of profound emotional pain. Desperation to be seen when you don't have the courage to use your voice and be heard. We need to hear them. We need to see them. We have to understand. The things that really devastate people, the problems that hurt most, are always the ones they can't talk about. We would do better to live in a world where people try harder to understand the ways we communicate when we don't have the words. And that's why we've been gifted with so many people on a spectrum, ranging from those who can't articulate anything to those who can teach languages you didn't even know existed. The silent ones, where you can be heard and felt without any noise at all. It creeps up on you slowly, like texting, email, and social media posts. And soon enough, nature is like, let's teach symbolic imagery so we can understand each other's emotions in silence. And why is this happening in conjunction with the Earth becoming hot and polluted while we're forced into space? Because those conditions decreasingly allow consumption of oxygen until there is none at all. Your voice is being stolen along with your body, and so in society, our suffering is often related to the injustice of being silenced or not being heard or not being understood. The sooner you come to realize your reality is nothing more than an advertising campaign for what's to come in evolution, the more quickly you can solve mysteries related to behavior. Speaking is going to become seriously unpopular as the technology related to neural implants improves and gets closer to fruition. In a naturally oxygenated environment, speaking makes a lot of sense. In space, it does not. Up there, it's inefficient, extremely dangerous, and in the shortest supply. That's why people on the spectrum, to a greater or lesser extent, depending upon where they fall, force understanding of nonverbal communication. That's what I'm doing for my audience, teaching communication through symbolic structure and specifically the search for the truth, because that's all we do in evolution. On the other end of the spectrum, people who can't articulate do the opposite, which is force you to teach them, thereby ironically teaching you, because nonverbal methods often have to be employed. A neurodivergent reality is often a more literal and seemingly objective reality that's rigid due to structural adherence to how things are built, rather than the societal norm of how they're perceived. We often feel like machines because we're built like them. Your toaster or your car have no functionality that creates perception beyond design. They simply perform a function, and that function creates perception, whether it's boring like the toaster or exciting like the car. Some neurodivergent people are built like the race car intellectually, and others are built like the toaster. But no matter where they fall on the spectrum, the goal is to be heard in silence. If you think about what you want emotionally more than anything else, experience should tell you that it's to be understood without saying a word. Every man who has ever dated a woman and asked, "What's wrong?" only to hear her say, "Nothing," when the subtext says something is definitely wrong, knows that what she wants more than anything else is to be understood for this suffering without having to articulate it. Why? Because realization cannot be undone. If she says it in the absence of his realization, it can be easily forgotten and ignored. But that which rises from the abyss of the unconscious mind in the form of realization cannot be unrealized and cannot be submerged to ignorance. When we see someone who is upset and unwilling to talk to us, we utilize symbolic imagery combined with information in the form of our past thoughts to garner truth. In doing so, we, along with the other person, both indulge nonverbal communication, which is why your best, most loving moments in life happen in silence. You think of it as the experience of love, in the sense that two people should be able to find the harmony to communicate without words. But nature is like, "Yo, I got another evolutionary billboard to post along this road that says you clowns need to believe anything that will force more nonverbal communication in the absence of oxygen." I mean, just think of how many people today, as opposed to 20 or 30 years ago, refuse to talk on the phone. You can't show up at anyone's house anymore. You need to make yourself known silently. Text, email. If you leave the average person a voicemail, they just delete it, unheard. If you go to a restaurant, in many cases, it's perfectly fine to ignore everyone at the table while you use your phones. I've texted people who are in the same room with me. When you go into places symbolic of truth, such as a courtroom or church, they expect you to silence your phone. Verbal communication is frowned upon there. For you, it's about social standards. But evolution is like, "I got you fools again." When news breaks, it's a fact that it can be broken faster in silence. You used to read about it in the newspaper the next morning, but today it's captured in HD video by 376 witnesses using smartphones from every angle you could imagine. Sociopathy and the crime derived from it simply manifest shortcuts to our future reality. Robert and John wanted to tell us their story and be understood without saying it. Nature has you walking around asking why murdered people were killed, because the truth can only be found in nonverbal communication. People ask, "Why are there so many false confessions? I would never say I did something I didn't do." Come on. The world doesn't work like that. The idea of false confessions is to show that confession is garbage in terms of establishing truth. It is a verbal assertion of truth in a world in which we were specifically afforded spoken language to tell lies. Compare the idea of someone's DNA being present in the bloody struggle at a crime scene with a person saying they did or did not commit the crime. The nonverbal DNA, which is literally nonverbal writing utilizing symbolic imagery, speaks with definitive information. It is specifically symbolic imagery which allows it to tell the truth, and even more specifically, absolute truth that can't be disputed. Now, as I say nonverbal here, I mean in the context of unspoken. Traditionally, written communication is still technically verbal. Now, in your house, have you ever told a kid to go to their room and be quiet so they can think about what they did wrong in order to have a realization that they need to evolve? That's what the Father or Creator is doing to us collectively. It's obviously why so many of your favorite public events where verbal interaction is paramount are now tainted by the threat of plague and death in the form of COVID and gunfire. You're more likely to order dinner through an app than a server at a table. All the places where chatter ruled are getting obliterated by silent alternatives. If you want to meet somebody today, the easiest way is through silence on an app. This is all being done in the context of our ascension narrative. We have to extract the circle, or earth, and so in this case, we should expect to see the same. Let's talk about the violence on top of the hill at the train tracks now, and we'll see the manifestation of that idea and the rest of what I talked about coming to bear. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Most of us give a lot of thought to taking care of our bodies, but how often do we discuss ways to maintain or improve the health of our minds? To make this pursuit a priority, we need to find methods to support a healthy brain, like learning a new language or taking naps. There's also BetterHelp online therapy. In my own experience, I've found therapy very helpful over the years, but in more recent times, while working at home, traditional means of therapy, such as visiting an office and seeing someone in person, have become less convenient. Fortunately, BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat-only therapy sessions, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/CCMM. That's BetterHelp.com/CCMM. So first off, this hill leading up to the tracks. Why here? We know why it ends on the tracks, but why did they choose this place? Why is this the end of the line? Like, why is this the last resort before the murder happens? Well, pretty easy. If you're a child being abused in your home by an authority figure and want it to stop, then the idea is that you need to go to a higher authority who has the power to make that happen legally. For a child, the most accessible and powerful of those entities available at your disposal would likely be a police officer, as they can both take you to safety and investigate the matter legally. Of course, there's the obvious implication that they provide the greatest protection against the threat because they are literally armed to protect people. So Robert and John, having failed to get any other adults to stop them, take the finale of this trip on foot to the hill leading up to the train tracks, which is, not coincidentally, directly across the street from and facing a police station. But again, they can't tell anyone the truth with words. It has to be realized within the imagery. So they're hoping they'll be seen by the cops abusing this little boy and stopped, which of course will make the cops wonder why and hopefully realize it's revenge for what was done to them, leading to the boys escaping their abuse, both in the case of James's ordeal, as well as what Robert and John suffered. It would be a win for everybody. But nobody speaks that language. Hitting this kid in public doesn't even get it done. Now, they get to the top of the hill, which is symbolic of physically manifested progress, or ascension. In the universe, the hill, so to speak, as displayed in the Doppler effect, is the blue wave of progress colliding with the red giant of tradition, or the intersection of what has been with what will be. The progress is what's coming, so it's the blue shifted light, and the tradition is what's going, or red shifted light. Of course, going up that hill signifies extracting the circle, or boy, in favor of the straight line, aka the man. In the context of being a boy, it means you leave the circle, or home, without mom, and go out on the straight line of the hunt separated from her, which makes you a man by symbolically killing the boy that you were. Here, though, in sociopathy, it's literal. Now, what do these two killers really want? They don't really want to kill James. What they truly want is to leave the abusive situation at home they find themselves trapped in every day, which is why they want the police to see them for who they really are, by extension of what they're doing to James being what was done to them. You have to look at it with a mirror, right? So if you wanted to get out of this situation, what might you say? I want to leave, or something like that. But since we have already walked up this hill, manifesting the physical equivalent of the necessary emotional growth to accomplish that goal, and are foregoing the actual creation of blue shifted light leading to progress that allows the boys to leave home, aka extract the circle, in favor of becoming the singularity through growth, what do they do instead to tell us the same with symbolic imagery? They throw blue paint they shoplifted into one of James's eyes to extract the circle symbolically. Now think about that. If you said, "I want to leave," and then walked up the hill to manifest that idea, making its transformation become past tense in the form of "I left," into which eye would you, as the perpetrators, throw the blue paint? Think about the mirror again. Well, they throw it into his left eye to manifest the emotional idea of "I want to leave" becoming material progress, resulting in the successful statement of reaching their goal with "I left." So left eye becomes "I left" because our physical reality is a mirrored or projected version of our emotional life reflected back at us. And of course, we see why they feel so hopeless as kids in these homes. Because they can't leave. They're 10 years old. There is no way out. And they don't feel safe enough to tell anyone the truth. This desire to leave is irreconcilable against their current reality unless they manifest a circumstance in which someone sees this and stops them. It doesn't happen because suffering is the conduit to evolution. We know better now. We're starting to bring our emotional lives to the surface, and we can begin to do better. But when this happened, it was all pitchforks and torches for the mob. And again, we know that the symbolic resonance of the straight lines of the rails never touching is extremely important, as it's the killer's emotional truth, which renders a structural inevitability that dictates whatever is going to kill James will be the thing that makes the rails touch each other. Accordingly, they find a 22-pound or 10-kilogram iron bar called a fish plate and use it to bludgeon James. Now, most people are just going to indulge you in the horror of being hit in the head with an iron bar. But again, we're going deeper to learn more. What does a fish plate do exactly? Well, it's a thick section of iron used to connect two lengths of separate rails as one. Quite literally, it makes two rails touch. It makes them come together and join as one, which was the greatest fear these boys faced about their future together in light of their sexuality coming to bear. They wanted to run alongside each other as friends and never grow up into that unified relationship being lovers. And given that this awareness developed early due to corrupted sexuality, they weren't properly equipped to deal with it rationally. It was terrifying. They couldn't talk about it, nor could they talk about the abuse, leaving silent physicality as a means to seek resolution in an otherwise irreconcilable circumstance. Now, where is the issue taking place for these boys emotionally? Obviously, inside their heads. So if they're projecting this fish plate onto James, where are they going to hit him with it? Well, let's just say that James receives 10 skull fractures from it. So think about that. They use the disconnected fish plate they find, manifesting the idea of them not coming together and touching each other as they move forward in life, which means the two rails are what in that state? Separated. As ridiculous as it sounds, one stiff rail isn't going to touch another. They stay apart. That's what the disconnected fish plate manifests. So again, this murder manifests killing the necessary emotional change, aka the truth. And since we live in a binary universe that dictates both transcendence and irony in everything we do, this grand act of separation ensures John and Robert are what? Connected forever. Almost never is one of these guys mentioned exclusive of the other. Now, like I said earlier, the universe is essentially an electrical charge with an alternating balance equating to zero, meaning positive charge, negative charge, and neutral charge. Neutrality is most often afforded by the collision of positive and negative values balanced to zero. So, if you put batteries in an electronic device, one side offers a positive side, and the other negative, allowing neutrality or balance. In this case, along with the blue paint, John and Robert shoplifted batteries. Now, just like the battery has two access points at opposing ends, so does the male body. Traditionally, if we were talking about consumption, the mouth is where it comes in, and the ass is where it goes out. But if you were examining the nature of potential sexual acts between two males, those places might also be locations where the straight line both goes in and comes out. So, as John and Robert are trying to manifest balance, or a neutral charge, and in relation to such activity, they stuff batteries in both James's mouth and his anus. Like the electronics, you get equal charges at both ends, manifesting balance and physicality. But again, these kids are so traumatized by telling anyone that even when they put the batteries in James's anus, they proceed to remove them in order to try to prevent anyone from knowing. But the cops figure it out in their investigation anyway. Even just indulging the symbolism of it is too much for them. So they remove the batteries from his anus, but look what happens. They strip James and make him suffer the indignity of having these acts forced upon him, matching what they suffered, and then they leave him in silence, unable to tell anyone, unable to escape. The difference, though, between him and them is that James finds peace. These boys never do. And of course that happens because James finds it physically, and these boys are unwilling or unable to change emotionally in life to have the same. Now, with the batteries removed from the anus and only existing in the mouth, look what we get. Imbalance. Notice that they want to manifest symbolic rebirth in relation to sexuality, but without emotional growth. So James is naked from the waist down in preparation for symbolic rebirth, but clothed above that on his upper half because it's being refused emotionally. When we indulge emotional change, we strip the ego or comfort or outer layer in favor of the naked singularity or authentic self. So here, since the boys are refusing emotional change, aka in the head, they leave the hooded coat on the victim while removing everything below the kid's waist. So we have an imbalanced charge now that the lower body has been depleted of the batteries, manifesting the idea of disunity between body and mind. And if we ask what's causing it, meaning the battery, where is it located? Inside the victim's head, which is a projection of what's going on inside the perpetrator's heads. On that note, we see the same with the clothing. Imbalance between lower and upper body. Like the batteries, it's present on the top half, absent on the bottom. What all of this says is that they want to separate the body from the mind because the mind is communicating with the sexual organs in their lower bodies. If they remove the power from those lower bodies, it will give their minds the power they need to move on from this disunity. So the victim ends up with batteries in his mouth. They decline to empower the lower body, so to speak, and remove the batteries not only to conceal their shame, but to manifest the idea of giving their brains power over their bodies by removing those desires from their conscious minds. Ultimately, however, even in physicality, the lower body is still attached to the upper body. So what do they do to manifest separation? After beating James nearly to death, or even to death at that point, they drag him onto the train tracks. Needless to say, he'll be found 2 days later, on Valentine's Day, having been severed by a train that disconnected his lower body from his upper body, or his lower body from his mind. There was no connection between the two anymore. Before the boys left him to that fate, they stacked bricks, rocks, and other debris on James's head, which was intended to keep him in place, aka stuck, and specifically by way of placing a heavy burden upon his head that he could never escape because he was already physically dead, manifesting the idea that these boys couldn't escape theirs because they died emotionally through the process of disunity between body and mind. That disunity specifically being the fact that they were in boys' bodies and having these sexual realizations of men. They couldn't move forward in life because they were stuck in that place emotionally as their bodies were being reborn. So they left James like that to tell us how it hurt. And we should listen to that silence. We should view the artist's work, no matter how disgusting it might ever become, because beneath the facade is truth. These were children who were hurting very badly. And they were all victims. So on an evolutionary level, or collectively, what we learn is that the time in which we could move along the rails of life with children is now coming to an end. Very slowly, but surely. As reproductive biology gives way to artificial replication, obliterating gender or sex, mother and son are separated permanently within the context of AI. The circle is extracted, finally allowing equality for all along the straight line of the hunt. Nature crafts these narratives with exquisite detail. Just think of what James's mom acquired right at the moment he disappeared. What was she doing in terms of modern equivalence? Hunting. She leaves that butcher shop with fresh meat from the hunt, and without the burden of a child to weigh her down. That's the future of women. When she lets go of his hand and pays for the meat, that sacrifice is the actual cost. It's the price women pay for this exchange. Kids disappear. It's a profoundly beautiful, sad, and tragic moment one that you can't indulge unless you allow us to speak to you without words. By going into the pet shop, they try to bring the animals back to life, meaning that they try to reverse course on the mother and they themselves, leaving on the hunt. What they wanted, more than anything else, I'm sure, is for Denise, James's mother, to realize her little boy was gone and desperately try to save him from his abusers. It's why they walked around casually in public after the abduction. They didn't run away, hide the child, or take back roads. All of this was right out in the open. Why? Because what they really wanted to see in that moment was Mom come running for her little boy, realizing the truth about what was really happening. She would save him. It never happened for them, so they wanted to manifest it, as doing it for James would also lead to authorities learning why the boys had acted out like this. But sadly, James's mother never shows up, and neither do the police. If you were one of these boys, you'd have been certain that this casual 2.5-mile walk in broad daylight after a child abduction, in which you were literally abusing the kid in front of adults, would lead to an arrest, or the mom showing up, or someone definitively stopping them. It's almost unfathomable that didn't happen. But they needed it to. And when they reached the end of the line, on trying to be noticed in the absence of words, the only solution they felt could suffice was the most extreme: murder. But in the end, after committing this terrible act, those boys walked away from the crime scene as the uncrossed ones, not becoming redundant as men or the father, and symbolically killing the child inside them, but like the rails, arranged side by side, never touching, moving into the future, as boys, something they would always be. So yes, in society, we absolutely do need to recognize the horror of these acts. But even more importantly, we must also understand that this depravity has meaning. When people get damaged on the outside, it shows us how the people who hurt them felt on the inside. Just like I said, the physical reality is a projection of your emotional world. By reverse engineering those symbolic images rendered from feeling, you can establish a narrative consistent with why the crime happened. Now, just to show you that these disturbed boys were really undergoing some type of shared psychosis in which they believed rebirth was possible, when Robert Thompson was arrested, he asked if James had been taken to the hospital to, quote-unquote, make him alive again. They smashed his skull with a big piece of iron, causing 10 fractures, and piled rocks on his head, leaving him to get chopped in half by a moving train. And Robert Thompson is surprised to hear he wasn't made whole again. We're talking about a 2-year-old. Imagine what a 22-pound, short, thick iron slab would do to a 2-year-old's head when dropped from above over and over again. The level of trauma these perpetrators endured in terms of abuse is entirely apparent within their crime. While Robert Thompson seemed to possess very little, if any, capability to feel remorse, John Venables played the part of his polar opposite, claiming such. Yet beneath that facade, we learn that the only difference between the two is that Venables was able to pretend. In truth, Like a lot of child abusers who target prepubescent kids with fewer anatomical differences brought on by blossoming sexuality, Venimals didn't have a preference between boys and girls when acquiring child porn. When he was later arrested for having child porn on his computer, the authorities suggested that there were images, even those involving penetration, of children between the ages of 2 to 8. It's sickening. But John Venables became the corrupted abuser because he was exposed to one. It's a cycle of abuse, one in which prey becomes predator right into perpetuity. So while there's more to this case, especially in terms of the legal considerations, I think the moment I want to close on here is something I'm reminded of from the last episode. I said, there are no good guys and bad guys, only two sides of the same glass with the monster staring back at us from the other end, waiting to break through. In this case, while holding his mother's hand inside the store, James turned toward the storefront glass and saw the monster staring back. Those monsters were John Venables and Robert Thompson, who, from their perspective, needed to kill the child inside their emotional world, James Bulger, in order to make things okay again. James is their past, and they are his future, with everything merging in the middle. So like boys do, they eventually let go of mom's hand to venture toward their future selves, toward becoming, while those hurt by the process try to return. And if you're returning, it goes without saying, you've come to kill something that simply would not die inside your head. James, by letting go of Denise's hand, was simply doing what kids that age often do, taking his earliest steps in becoming a big boy that moves forward without mommy. That's something he would want to prove to the older boys. He did. It wasn't more than a few steps, but going past that barrier is a point of no return. By leaving the store and transcending that glass wall, James symbolically stepped out of his emotional world where they could finally kill him. So why couldn't James let go, even as a 2-year-old? Why couldn't the others? Well, the 7th deadly sin, the granddaddy of them all, is pride. Even toddlers suffer it. We never let go emotionally. So to tell us what killed James just reversed that idea into physicality, and look what you get. He let go of his mother's hand while she was paying. And what would she have received from paying that price? Change, but physical change, specifically something significantly less than she started with. James manifested maturation by walking away from his mother toward his older self to prove a point, and he paid the price of being torn apart like the dead animals being sold inside the store. Quite simply, he became prey to predators. But what we really need to understand is that those 2 10-year-old killers learned how to pull this off so masterfully because somebody did the same to them emotionally. Somebody lured them across that threshold and killed their childhood. So when they saw an opportunity to do it to James physically and bring balance, they pounced. Given this cycle of abuse, it's not difficult to see that children are the victims here. In our individual lives, we grow to leave our childhood bodies and minds behind because we evolve to become something greater. That happens as a species too. But in the meantime, we will suffer the little children, and they'll suffer us. So if there's any invisible barrier you choose to place between yourself and these kids, let it be love.